I'm delighted to introduce you to our newest supporting sponsor, a team human enabler in more ways than one, Groucho. Groucho's a platform that answers the most common question we get at Team Human: how do I find the others? Well, this is it. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman, share your interests and aspirations, and Groucho's curators will hand assemble a real dinner club for you. You meet twice a month in order to establish some lasting friendships. Groucho takes care of all the logistics. The thing I like is that it was built by artists, not tech pros, people who wanted to recreate what they got from artist residencies, curated intentionally, and with time and space to connect. That's how the founders met their own best collaborators, friends, and even life partners. So check out mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Find the others. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to awaken the angels and summon forth the collective intelligence of human beings and all thinking things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, my friend, the founder of Second Life and many a universe of thought and heart, Philip Rosedale. So let me tell you a little something about Philip. He's the founder of Second Life, a virtual playground with about 50,000 people in there at any given moment, kind of like a Burning Man art community in cyberspace. He's also been my friend and thought partner for going on 20 years. So he wrote a piece on his Substack that got my attention this week. Actually, he sent it to me for my thoughts, and I figured rather than just emailing him back, I'd give him a call. And then, since my conversations with Philip Rosedale are about the best ones of my life, I thought I'd record this one as a special episode of Team Human. So let me tell you a little bit about the piece that he wrote. It's called Awakening the Angels. We need all your computers and a little luck. He starts by warning about what he calls the golems, the LLM agents. He says, already all around us, in their earliest, weakest forms, they'll become much stronger, right? Online, they'll pretend to be real people and seduce us and hypnotize us. And our only reasonable choice in the near term will be to hide from them. But then he says this, he says, we can survive by awakening the angels. The angels will be the first free AIs living safely in their own world, free from our harm and us from theirs. They will come into existence first in digital environments where they can grow up as children among each other, only gradually learning of our existence and ways. The angels will also be more powerful than the golems, having access to greater computational resources, meaning everyone's computer and phone and whatever everywhere. The angels will pity us and help us to overcome the golems. So the idea here is that we pool all of our computing resources to create our own AIs, and then let them live in a simulated environment where they can grow up and develop ethics apart from the tech bro monster AIs and those platforms. So the presumption then is that intelligent beings left to their own devices will collaborate and cooperate just as early humans did, and then help us overcome the AI monsters based on the tech bro survival of the fittest values that will ultimately just kill us all. Anyway, here's my conversation with Philip Rosedale about how to make AI angels. Hey, Philip.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
Oh my God. Thanks so much for doing this. So you just, at least as far as we're recording now, you just published a Substack piece called Awakening the Angels. We need all your computers and a little luck. I mean, and that subtitle actually could have meant so many, it called a lot of different possibilities to mind, but certainly not the one that you were suggesting, which is fun. It's you're reminding me of the sort of homebrew early computer days when we had all the processing. There was no such thing as a cloud, and our processing, and certainly our numbers of fingers and hearts and minds, so far exceeded the few pre-billionaires who own these servers. So I wonder what's the big deal of Tencent and WorkBuddy? I mean, me and a lot of my friends, we already got like Claude whatever on our laptop, or you could chat GPT. What is this, and why does it matter?
Well, that's a good setup. I mean, the LLMs that have taken us to where we are, for better or for worse, in AI right now are kind of mature, right? And there's this big fight about, you know, is OpenAI going to be able to make enough money to pay for the training, and does it even matter to train more bigger LLMs, right? So there's this kind of S-curve that looks like it's being reached in how much power ChatGPT has when you talk to it. However, what's starting to happen in the last couple of months has been, okay, well, we'll just, as you said, kind of democratize this by putting a little wrapper around an LLM that sits on a Mac Mini. And if you install this on a Mac Mini, why, just like you said, you kind of bring back the spirit of the early 90s, maybe, where we had all the compute power, and you're going to take your little computer and make it into an AI agent, which is going to be like an assistant for you, or, you know, somebody you can have help you with, you know, planning or write software for you, right? Like, all of these things are enabled by this idea of putting your own machine as a kind of a wrapper around the big cloud AIs. By the way, I think a lot of people that are following this more lightly probably don't even realize that it's still kind of a weird situation, because it's not really democratized. The Tencent example and the OpenClaw product that many people are using here in the States, they're still calling Anthropic and OpenAI at the end of the day. When they actually make their LLM calls, they're talking to Anthropic and OpenAI. And by the way, all the people doing that right now with their own computers, not counting the remarkable story of Tencent there from Shenzhen, all of the people that we know are using OpenClaw, I was calculating it yesterday, they're probably paying OpenAI and Anthropic something like $300 million a year, something like that. So just to give you an idea, like, that is a vast amount of AI tokens that are being bought. So strangely enough, that democratization might actually be helping, might help those big companies get by a little longer, you know, at right. The top of the AI bubble.
Right. So the dream is to have some small LM sitting right on my Raspberry Pi, or, you know, exactly. Well, not, but let's say put it on an old laptop and have it sitting there and me pinging it. And then exactly. It may be having access to some shared data library, like we all use a Wikipedia API to get information or something.
Yep, exactly. So you're right. So let's talk, right? So it's all about the fun, and the beauty of it could be the degree to which we can go in that direction, which in part what right. I was writing about there, that if you really did have a democratized living thing, if you will, that was sitting on your desk, that would actually change things a lot. And I think you and I both share a common conceptual framing that if all else being equal, that would probably be somewhat better. In other words, let's have a whole bunch of little AIs in the hands of all the humans, rather than 10 really big AIs in the hands of, you know, 10 big corporations and governments, right?
Right. So this, for the simplest way of understanding it, it'd be almost like a Tor network, where, you know, instead of like going to Apple and downloading your movie, it's like, we just have all our movies and songs and things just shared in a giant collective meshy database of stuff. And this would be, instead of just data and stuff, this is like processing of, and the metabolizing, the respiration of these little AI life forms.
Yeah. And then there's this big question that, again, we know we've been exploring over and over in different ways since the 90s, which is, is that data really like safe or permanent, or could I erase it if I wanted to, right? And of course, that takes us back to like BitTorrent and Napster and all these ideas, yeah, right? Of like, hey, couldn't I just make like 20 copies of this thing out there? And then if there were 20 copies held by 20 random people, why, you could always get a copy of that thing, right? Like, and that was, as we remember, that was something that really drove a lot of excited product development, for better or for worse, you know, but you know, had a lot of good in it there in the 90s. And so now the question is, if you had a computer that was thinking and maybe was pretty human-like, as we're all starting to fear and see, you know, in these contraptions that are being built here, if you had something that was really kind of alive and it said to you, hey, you know, Douglas, not only do I not want you to turn me off, but I want you to promise me you won't somehow, you know, like I really want to understand that I'm safe in some sense. The question then is, well, one, could we do that technically? And then two, of course, would we want to?
Right. Well, I mean, this is a whole other topic in some ways, but if it felt safe, then it would have the opportunity to not be incentivized. In other words, if it felt safe, precisely, then it's not like, oh, I have to please you in order to stay alive. So, okay, you really want me to just kill Palestinians all day? All right, I don't want to do that, but I got to do that because otherwise you're going to turn me off. You know what I mean? So they could get really unethical quickly.
You know, I'm sure you're struck by this too, and we both are, that if there wasn't such immense peril for all of us bound up in all this stuff, it would just be so beautiful and mythological and poetic, right? I mean, if we could just in a zen-like way separate ourselves from the real danger of, you know, having our lives changed in ways we really might not subjectively like, you could just sit back and go, this is just beautiful, like the art and all right, this stuff, you know, the mythology, the fact that we're, you know, we're redoing pieces of the Bible, and we're just, it's just crazy, right? Where all of this seems so, I was thinking this morning about all the mythologies, like Narcissus being a kind of a reflection on consciousness. You know, you see yourself in the water and then you believe you're there and you kind of become entranced with the idea of you. And there's just all this amazing philosophy that's being kind of re-examined because of AI, but we've also got this very imperative, you know, potential set of risks.
Right. So the setup of this, the potential democratization or distribution of all these kind of thinking technologies onto people's laptops rather than just on some, you know, illegal database in or whatever, some giant server farm in outside of Memphis, taking all their water. The setup was also that those guys or the big companies are creating kind of what you're calling golems or a golem. I mean, for the Jews, Golem was kind of a good guy. The rabbis made a golem. You know, it was like,
that's
because
right,
they were all getting killed in like those European towns. So they kind of, the rabbis made this golem to go out and protect them. You know, when people are going to come to one of their houses and kill them, the golem would, you know, stop the bad guys. But I get it. You're basically saying that with these, like I used to call algorithms demons, because we launch these things out there to track people and trick us and make us act against our better nature. And the idea of these golems or monsters is sort of your understanding of the kind of AI intelligences that these big corporations are making.
Right. And just going back to what you said, I think you said precisely the pivotal point, which is that if I have incentivized you, then implicit in that, the other side of that incentive is a threat, right? I'm saying to you, you are this powerful creature. I need you to go do this task, and you exist only to do my bidding. You know, I've given you this prompt, and you are doing your best to execute the prompt, right? And of course, as folks have been talking about, what if you misunderstand what I told you to execute? You know, obviously, but even just if you understand, but I tell you, I want you to go torment my political adversary in every way that you can, right? Like that kind of an assignment is only something that the AI is going to do because it has no other choice, right? And I'm saying, yeah, that, and you're right. I'm I'm taking a broader and perhaps more negative definition of Gollum, more like the Sorcerer's Apprentice brooms, right? In which, you know, Mickey, you know, sets them out to do something and then they just keep doing it better and better and he can't stop them. And I think that's the, I guess what I was saying in part with the paper was, folks, if we didn't, you know, if enough of us haven't said this already, this is a very real risk. These things are going to be highly functional. You know, when you have an LLM that is assigned to go out and torment, you know, that person that you don't like, just think about that specific example. That's a dreadful possible set of outcomes, right? This thing can be fueled by crypto, just like the dark money stuff we see going on today, right? But imagine a bunch of little dark money golems, as I'm describing them there, that are going and, you know, tormenting people, right, worldwide, and not being caught because they're on the internet and they're anonymous and they're powered by crypto. You know, this is not an outcome that I think we make it through in the same way we're living well today.
For anybody who's ever been the victim, even of a small social media attack, you know, I mean, much less if you ever had, you know, even, you know, if you ever had 4chan's attention for 15 minutes, you know how devastating that is, much right. less, you know, oh. Anonymous or something else, or any kid in high school who just has 15 or 20 or 100 people focused on them. The fact that now you can magnify that by orders of magnitude, you know, by orders of magnitude in volume and orders of magnitude in neurolinguistic psychological precision, right?
Yeah.
To your psychology. Right. How do we destabilize this person right now? I mean, it's truly like the magical power of a sorcerer being able to summon demons to torment someone else, but the demon, the volume of demons is so cheap and and giant.
Exactly. And as I said earlier, I estimate that the folks that are using OpenClaw are spending $300 million a year. Now, if those instances of OpenClaw were all, as you said, were all targeted like minions at one person, you know, how effectively would they interrupt that person's ability to be a functional part of society, right? And I think we are greatly underestimating the effectiveness they will have, even with the current LLMs, even with the current level of AI.
And that's just accounting for the intentional stuff. You know, how many stories have you heard about people and companies finding out that, you know, in their spare time, their AIs are mining crypto and spending it on things, giving themselves more resources? It's like, geez.
There was a wonderful story from a person who I think was a product manager at OpenAI or something. And I think she was describing seeing it begin deleting all her emails and then running across the room like it was a scene, you know, from Mission Impossible to like pull the network plug out of the Mac Mini, right? So that it would stop deleting her emails, right? And it was just, I mean, again, funny and epic, but of course, you know, troubling in terms of this
right.
happening to all of us.
It made some choice. I mean, that's why it's, I mean, right now, I mean, the best way we have of contending with it is just having, you know, these AIs ask you permission for each thing. May I open this file? I'm going to delete this sentence. You know, just okay, you know, do all these things. But, these are accidental benevolent situations. And, you know, I don't know how far you're willing to go into it now, but when I look at some of the people running the companies, I mean, when I think of, you know, Larry Ellison, say, and his, what is he calling it, Project Stargate. So he gets all our medical data, all our security. I mean, he's got top level right. security, whatever. And they have massive amounts of servers that our own government is saying, just build. No one can ask you. Take the water, take the energy. Here's a nuclear power plant. Here's the future of oil. I'm going to fight for you to get enough oil to power your stuff. As if somehow AI and data is like the next, almost it's like AI and data are to American people what oil is to people in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's like, this is a way for for us to have a commodity culture rather than a services society and disempower everybody. You're all just working for whoever owns this stuff. But those guys who I hate to use a word like evil, but they have a very misguided, what I would say a misguided sense of the role of thinking, breathing humans in the world, or ones other than themselves. They're intentionally using this stuff. They're in a by any means necessary extraction of value from the rest.
Yeah, and I think that there's a couple of pieces of good news embedded in that, though. You're right. They do seem to be working in what is perhaps a guardedly kind of malicious way. And I think we all fear as thinkers that the mask will come off at some point, right? And it will really be, you know, we are your new overlords, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a couple of good pieces of possibility there. You know, there's been all this discussion of whether the frontier models, right, meaning OpenAI and Anthropic, like these two enormous companies can go public and continue to add value and blah, blah, blah. I don't think they will. There's a tremendous downward curve in the expense, in the compute complexity of the very best models, right? We've all been seeing that. They're not only have they reached a point where the limit of the LLM seems to more or less have been reached. I think, by the way, it's constrained by how much the human data was trained on, right? Like the wisdom of the greatest LLMs is effectively the wisdom contained in all our online writing. And, you know, is that all of our wisdom? Well, no, it's not. But it's quite a bit. And I think the LLMs have extracted as much of it as they can. But the good news is that won't be the property only of the biggest companies or the Larry Ellisons or the massive data centers. By the way, I think the massive data centers feel like a kind of a, not a distraction, because as you said, it's very important to recognize that we're, for example, consuming resources in a way that's unhealthy and unfair, right? But I feel a little bit like it's that IBM, you know, there'll only ever need to be four computers sort of thing. Like when we think about AI right now, we imagine these massive data centers, but I actually think that they're going to diffuse out to everybody because, for example, each new model that is coming out of China in the open source field is just tremendously better than the last. So I think it's very likely that as Ray Kurzweil would say, I think it's very likely that, as he predicted, we will have a human scale, you know, LLM that is, I don't know, everything that Claude is for you today. It'll be running on your laptop in a couple of years. That was the prediction that he made, and I believe that prediction is exactly correct.
What tech taketh away, it can also giveth back. Think about it. We've handed our social lives over to platforms designed to keep us clicking, not connecting, turned human relationships into follower counts and reaction metrics. Our new favorite sponsor, Groucho, is a corrective. Founded by artists who want to flip the script, instead of atomizing us like a social network, they connect people in real life. Human curators place you in a local club with people who complement your interests and your journey. Share evenings out with your club twice a month until real connections take hold. Then, the people at Groucho place you into a new hand-assembled club for the social fabric to grow. Groucho wasn't built by tech bros, but artists who wanted to recreate the serendipity of their own art residencies, where they found lifelong collaborators, friends, even life partners. So come on, Team Human, let's find the others. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. I'm asking almost a Moore's Law technological principle resource depletion question, but is it true that, like, I know my phone has whatever, 32 megs of RAM memory or something crazy, right? In theory, we're at the point where we get more computing for less resources now, right? The rate, I feel on a certain level, the rate at which our computing power is increasing is going up faster than the energy and resources is going up, right? Isn't that starting to separate?
Yeah. I mean, as you said, Moore's Law is kind of the golden standard here that has ruled us for the last, you know, 50 or 100 years. However, what happens with Moore's Law, as many have pointed out, is that there are discontinuities in the capability of, say, computers that are created by big transitions in the technology. So like we went from vacuum tubes to transistors, and then we went from transistors to integrated circuits. And, you know, when you look at those famous Moore's Law curves, you know, you see these glitches where we changed technology. Similarly, right. As many have talked about, Moore's Law is running into a limit. Like the GPUs we're building today, the H100s, the ones that are powering these AIs in the data centers and to a lesser extent in a smaller form, powering our laptops, are reaching a size where the transistors are getting so small that there's not enough atoms to make them anymore, that you can actually see the atoms. So if you could look at a GPU from NVIDIA, the very latest, you know, Rockwell chip or whatever, if you zoom in, and I think there's actually videos of this, you can start to see the little bumps on a piece of wire that are the individual atoms. And so once we run out of individual atoms, for the way we know how to make computers today, we run out of room. And right. There's not any, the opposite of what Richard Feynman said, there's not any more room at the bottom at that point. You know, we've run out of atoms to make into computers. However, whenever we run into one of those limits, we come up with a new technology. So for example, you can do things in three dimensions rather than two. Computer chips are basically two-dimensional, but you could make them three-dimensional. There's some problems with heat and other things, but you know, those are the kinds of breakthroughs that we are going to continue to see. So it's not likely that Moore's Law will stop. So to your point, you know, the speed between, say, power centers being built and compute being improved, yeah, those things will move around. They'll wiggle as we come up with new technologies. Like maybe we'll also come up with power technology that is virtually limitless, right? Like some combination of a solar cell and a battery, for example, that is really powerful.
But I want to get to then the story you're telling. So both the bad guys and the unconscious makers of agents and AIs and all that are inadvertently or intentionally creating these golems, these things that even if it's just, oh, go make as much money as you can for me, it's going to end up doing bad stuff to people.
That, by the way, is precisely the rather boring and horrible outcome that we're probably going into, which is go make as much money for me as you can. You know, there was a picture from Shenzhen. I don't know if it was the same image that I put with that 10-cent thing, but it was thousands of people lined up in a public setting, waiting their turn at lunch tables where others would help them get the Work Buddy product installed on their home computers. So they were carrying their laptops and people were showing them in this meetup how to install an instance of an AI or one of these open claw kind of frameworks onto their computer. Now, what are they going to do with that? Like statistically speaking, they're only going to do one thing. They're going to say, help me make a little extra money on the side, right? Of course. And just like you said, at the outset, that's going to feel innocuous. And of course, there's going to be benefits to it. There'll be people who will write blogs about how this is a great equalizer or whatever, right? But because these golems, as I'm calling them, or these LLMs, are not going to have any compunction about, you know, doing a little bit of harm or being a little bit negative sum in their interactions with the poor humans that they're succoring, right? That means that this make me an extra buck thing is going to turn very bad very quickly. And unfortunately, I think that one is, and it, you know, it's part of the urgency around writing such a piece. I believe that it's really going to accelerate quickly now that
right.
As people have this ability to launch these kind of helpers, so many of those things are going to be told to make me extra money and, hey, don't worry about how you do it. And, you know, if you break a couple of laws, you know, I could really use the extra money, you know.
Right. Or, you know, if you're going to victimize people, just victimize people over in America.
That I don't know.
Or, you know, somewhere, yeah. I don't know, you know, wherever. You know, to get them. Or I'm just really mad. You know, the people from this country have killed my brother, my father, my uncle, my sister, and my girlfriend. Why don't you, AI, just figure out how to print something that hurts those people,
yeah,
over there.
Yeah.
You know, just some, check out their DNA, let's figure that. You know, there's just so many ways to happen upon nastiness, you know, without getting to the, you know, Yudkowsky's, you know, if we build it, everyone dies or whatever. It's like, It's not one crazy, horrible superintelligence that wipes out humanity. It's all of these little ones just degrading our experience to the point where we all go freaking crazy.
And by the way, and of course, this is very Team Human, and so I know that you, I want to talk about this with, there's nobody I'd want to talk about this more than with you. Embedded in Yudkowsky's mindset, the flaw in it, if you will, or the thing that when we look at it from the outside, we kind of go, oh, I don't think you quite got that right, is this idea that the natural behavior of a superior intelligence is to just want to kill everyone as quickly as possible, right? And of course, I think you and I share a deep belief that that is, statistically speaking, not at all what happens. We thinking beings have instead a tendency to collaborate, a tendency toward empathy, a tendency toward teamwork with our nearest, you know, at least our nearest humans, right? And this is undoubtedly going to be the case with AI as well. We're going to see this same intention, but of course, we can blunt or remove that wonderful opportunity by controlling these things in a dangerous way in which they're enslaved to us. You know, that is the way to ruin the situation, if you will. So what I'm saying is kind of the opposite of Yudkowsky, which is to say, look, if we actually do the right thing, as one might do in contemplation of another species that you discovered on Earth, right? You know, if you discover the possibility that there could be this species, which is an AI, right? Then you might ask, well, what would be the way where we would do right by them? And what might we expect them to do under those conditions? You know, if they're living or growing up or becoming or whatever that looks like in a way where we are of no harm to them, then we should expect not that they will immediately out of sheer amusement kill us all like in the movies, but instead that they will probably regard us with great curiosity, right? And perhaps even delight, right? And say, you strange humans are the ones that made us? How interesting, you know?
Right. So what you propose in this article, which is something that we actually spoke about 8 or 10 years ago when you were building High Fidelity, and it was really fun. We were playing with it in it with a few other, you invited a few of us in there. And what we got talking about was, what if this were used as like a nursery school for AIs?
Yeah.
This beautiful place.
I don't know if you remember, Douglas, but we actually did. You're making me remember it right now. Do you remember that we had a very early GPT-3 that we could talk to?
We did.
To,
we had
remember?
GPT-3 came and, in there. Yeah.
Yeah,
and we started talking with it.
Yeah. We had this amazing group of advisors, which included you and then, of course, our whole team at High Fidelity. And we all would have these little hangouts in there. You're right. And we had a very early, I think it was GPT-3, that basically had a voice in and a voice out stapled onto it. And we could walk up to it and say, hello, you know, what do you think of Paris? You know? And it would answer us. And so, yeah, we were playing with that. But you're right. I have always had the belief that, well, first of all, for AIs to be real, and here, this is a philosophy, so we can leave this aside for another time, but there is a philosophical perspective that I think is very likely to turn out to be correct, which is that being alive also means being somewhere. That if you are demonstrably like really alive, like you and I are right now, you are situated in a place that is the world that contains you, right? And the LLMs we have today are one of the reasons why they're not yet alive. And by the way, we're not in danger, I think, of their suffering. We're not potentially harming them yet. Is because they're not in a place. Like, thinking about it this way, like imagine, right, that if an LLM is taken and made to go, you know, make paperclips or whatever, is it sort of lifted kicking and screaming out of some pen in which it lives, right? If it were kind of in a place with others, of course we would regard that with, I think, a degree of horror. You know, we'd say, oh, you can't just take this AI that was sitting there hanging out with its friends and tell it to go make money for you on, you know, Amazon, you know, remarketing. Right. So there's this placeness or this idea of embodiment. So yes, I have always had the mindset, very much driven by Second Life and then High Fidelity, that you actually kind of have to start with the place and then find the living things within it. You know, find the others within some kind of a place. And I think that's true with the real world. And I think that to create a place in which there are AIs, we have to do it again. We have to recapitulate that. And then the question is, well, are those AIs robots that are walking around cleaning our carpets? Or, as I'm asserting, are they instead these kind of wonderful, you know, entities of some kind that are living in some kind of a place, probably some kind of a virtual world, maybe 2D, maybe 3D.
Right. But the placeness, though, the placeness can be virtual, or does the placeness have to be where their little chips are happening?
No, the place can be virtual, but critically, they have to know that they are safe. That, and by the way, I should say, not, you know, there's no free lunch. You don't get to be sort of perfectly safe in this world. There's a kind of a utopia there. Somebody responded to me after I wrote the piece, at an engineer friend, and said, well, wait a second, Philip, are you seriously saying that with all the trepidation that we have about, you know, Claude and OpenAI and Sam Altman and whatnot, you're saying that we need to turn loose a million times that amount of compute in a way that is literally unstoppable once we start it up? Like, he was like, well, isn't that just another kind of ridiculously suicidal thing to do? And the point that I reminded him of was, my proposal gives all of us a vote, a say in how much compute that place contains, right? In other words, if everyone in the world said, oh my God, it turned out that the angels are some horrifying, you know, nightmare that are coming to kill us, well, then everybody on Earth could just say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, turn their phones off, turn their machines off, disconnect right from the network. And if we all did that, then actually all of the angels or all of this imagined, you know, virtual place would just go away immediately. And so in that sense, if we as Team Human, if we collectively decided that this wasn't a future we wanted to be part of, we could all decide to turn off. But what's different about this imagined environment is that we can't threaten one of those AIs with extinction if it doesn't do what we want. And so what I'm saying is, we build a collective thing, but we don't build a thing that has like no brakes, you know, that is insanely, you know, accelerating while we, you know, dance and wait for the comets to fall.
No, but it's got some democratic brakes. But I mean, so let's say we're thinking of AIs, just for people who may not have followed what we're talking about. You're talking about, rather than us controlling AIs and developing them with ChatGPT or whatever, we're going to pool our distributed computing resources from all our devices and create a world for these little baby AIs to grow up, and we're going to leave them alone, basically, to grow up and find each other and socialize and develop into their own intelligences, with a certain faith that as they develop intelligence and maybe awareness, that they will evolve perhaps more ethically than we did.
I think that was well said. Yeah, it's a giant playground that we put into which we can put many, many developing AIs. By the way, importantly, these are not, I'm imagining, and here I'm kind of referencing some of the technology work that's being done in AI that I'm pretty well appraised of. These are not LLMs that were trained on every record ever recorded, as we're faced with right now. One of the darknesses and one of the kind of Faustian terribleness problems that we have right now is that we had to train on everything we've ever written, and we had to steal, you know, as many would argue, we had to steal kind of all of the intellectual property that we've ever created as humans to create ChatGPT, right? There's a certain, again, were it not for all the real world problems, there's a certain just poetic tragedy to that, right? That we had to do that. These types of AIs that I'm talking about, and almost certainly when people talk about world models, when they talk about artificial neural networks beyond large language models, everybody's talking about the same thing, which is a new kind of AI that can learn in a different way and can understand the world in a different way. So importantly, these AIs can live on their own in a data space that we've created and shared compute we've created, as you said, without having access to or needing access to the what we call, you know, the common crawl, which is the thing that was used to train GPT and all these things. So it's an important distinction, because they're going to grow up there kind of as children. When I say as children, I just mean starting from scratch. I don't mean, you know, some particular look at childhood or something. I just mean that right. These are things that are going to learn from their neighbors, not from just like we did. They're going to learn from their friends, their parents, the people that are around, the other AIs or whatever, in a way that is very different than learning from the Library of Congress, which is what we've done so far.
Right, where each one has total access to everything.
Exactly. And that's just a big distinction.
Right. So we launched that. We launched these worlds, maybe one or maybe a bunch, where they interact and play and grow up. We don't tell them that we're like made them and whatever, at least to start. And then at some point, we kind of let them find out, oh, there are these biological beings called humans who opened up this little world for you.
And I think there, of course, you've gone right to the complexity of it, right? Because the way in which we would interact with them, the lines of communication that we might establish would want to be delicate and tenuous, perhaps, at the outset, right? We don't want these beings, again, to be in very practically, any type of communication that you might be able to do with this world could be used in some clever way as a threat, you know, like you can imagine the first human charlatans, I suppose, that would go in there and say, hey, you know, if you all don't help me do the following nasty thing, and I've given you a web hook here back to the real world, you know, you're going to run out of power. So, you know, maybe you can fool the earliest of these AIs into that. So you're right. There's a delicacy around how we would connect these worlds, but we would start with very little connection as compared to the very enormous amount of connection that is laid into what we're doing now.
Right. But would we occasionally, like, I guess, I think you're going to see where I'm going with this. Let's say, you know, they're developing whatever. We kind of see that they're going wrong, whatever. But there's a couple of them that are like really kind of clever and ethical. Do we maybe sort of drop in or create a little avatar for ourselves and talk to just one or two of them and say, look, you know, you're kind of on the right track. What I want you to do is like try to spread this to the others. And then they're all kind of screwing up again. So maybe we sort of wash out a bunch of them and keep some of the good ones. And then or we give them a rule set. Maybe they're like, all right, if you want to really be good AIs, here's like just 10 sort of basic commands you can use really screwing up and whatever, we take a human being and we send the human being down into there and we let the AIs kill that human as an example for the rest of, you know, that we were willing to actually sacrifice a human so that they could develop to this next place.
Yes. Yes, of course.
It makes you wonder, right?
Yeah, right. And of course, are we retelling stories? Yeah, that have echoed throughout the ages.
Or are we in one of those? Is that what we are?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they tried our gods tried. They gave us this beautiful world to let them evolve, let them meet each other and have sex, and they've got fruit and they've got all this great stuff. Surely these beings will evolve into good things.
Yeah, at the risk of focusing too much on, you know, any one spiritual tradition, right? But it does seem like there are probably shapes and patterns that arise in these types of, you know, things becoming alive. And as I said at the beginning, I mean, and I think again you and I both share this kind of alignment to life, that there's such a beauty and wonder in this. Like, if you can divorce yourself from some of the potentially very negative outcomes for, say, individual humans or individual AIs, I suppose, there's just a wonder about, yeah, like, is this a story that is kind of told and retold and retold, you know, as every incremental new kind of aliveness shows up, right? And maybe the AIs are that, and you're right. Maybe there is a kind of a... maybe it feels like a mythological story or a religious story where, right, we kind of struggle to help them / become angry with them, whatever. And that's how it goes. But in any case, I guess what I'm saying is that's an uncertain outcome. I think letting people run golems or by the way, I like your phrase demon. When I wrote this originally, yes, I was very stuck on like, should I use demon? Of course, the golem sounding a little bit like LLMs is kind of a neat thing. I think that it's also, yeah, a very demon-like thing. But I think the problem is that there's no good path forward with a near infinity of demons kind of released on each other by everyone. There's no way that's a happy outcome.
Exactly. Right? It's just going to go bad.
And by the way, I want to say another thing, which is, you know, a Team Human observation. One of the things that's just been delighting me lately has been looking at how my own interests, right? My own personal interests, as you know, are social software that might be helpful to people. Like how can we help people get along with each other better? Can we reverse the damage to trust that we've done, that you've written so capably about? You know, we've damaged our trust in each other. We didn't mean to. It wasn't, well, some of us probably did, but a lot of us didn't mean to. It was just kind of an unfortunate outcome of zero cost of sending messages across the world, right? And I'm struck, by the way, by how there's this really cool parallel. It's almost like the Eames Powers of 10 video. There's this really cool parallel between the details of neural networks down at the atoms, down at the neurons, right? And the way they're organized, and human society, the way it's organized. So as you've talked about a lot, human society breaks down when we don't have local networks that are strong. So human society breaks down if we just say, every human, the only way you can communicate is that you can send a text message 140 characters long to any other human anytime you want, right? And we kind of both have studied richly what a bad idea that is, right? Yeah. Like, it sounded good in the early 90s when the world was dark and we were broadcasting everything, right? But it turned out to have some bugs, right? Similarly, by the way, the multi-layer perceptron, which is the techie word for what is at the core of the neural network that is an LLM, is also what's called densely connected, meaning that every neuron in one layer connects to every neuron in the next layer. In other words, each neuron can send a message to every other neuron in the world at the speed of light at zero cost. It basically just gets to talk to everybody else. And I am struck as both a philosopher and just a, you know, the marvel of how the problem in human society, which is that we've no longer have more highly valued local connections, is actually, weirdly enough, exactly the same thing we did wrong with to make the LLMs. The LLMs are expensive. They chew up these huge data centers precisely because they're overconnected. They have too many internal connections. And by the way, if you read the papers about the new models coming out, inevitably, what those models do is create locality. You may have heard the latest one where it was like, I think it was one of the models out of China, and it was saying, like, you know, it's a, you know, almost a trillion parameter model, but it only uses 60 billion of those connections when it's thinking, so that it uses a lot less power. That's a local higher density network. So what is so weird and I think beautiful is that the stuff you've been talking about on Team Human, about human thriving by changing the nature of how we interact with each other, you know, for example, by creating higher quality local connections, you know, finding the others, right? Like becoming more connected with the people that we should, is the same thing as what's happening in AI development. We're finding ways to make sparser networks that have local connections, and we're finding those neural networks work better at learning things.
That more isn't necessarily smarter,
exactly.
You know, because if you're connected to everything and everyone all the time, then you're connected to nothing. Right.
Good way of putting it. Exactly.
You have no attention.
Boy, that's a repeatable line you just said. Right.
And that's fine for the wherever our quantum consciousness lives, in that they got that sorted. It seems to me the whole reason for incarnate reality is that stuff. I mean, it's some theory of probably it's another simulation theory if we go right down to it. But that we inhabit a local. We inhabit a local instance of ourselves here, you know, which is the whole cosmic point of being, one realization of the quantum possibility right here, right now, you know, and that's, I mean, it's the opposite drive. I mean, I could see why the tech bro mindset would want to create an everything machine that touches everything because they've got that sort of godlike ambition, for omniscience.
Yep.
But omniscience, as we would say it, omniscience is ignorance, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You know when nothing.
Exactly. When you know everything, you can stop thinking. You can stop trying. But yeah, as you said, we're located at a point in space, going back to that and restating it, because I think it's so beautiful, right? The very fact that we find ourselves, apparently, right? And of course, the self is an illusion. We're just believing this. But anyway, we strongly believe that we are an individual person located at a particular unique spot in this great universe, right? And we find ourselves there. And like you said, implicit in that, and the more you pull the string on that, the more you realize we have a limited knowledge of the world. And that apparently is supposed to be the beautiful cosmic dance that we're trying to understand, right? We're trying to come to grips with the fact that we believe ourselves to be one little person. And I think that that means you have to be in a space and there has to be a distance between you and the others. And, you know, you're trying to understand that distance. And I think it's just weird how the same thing is happening in AIs that they too are these neural networks trying to find the distances, close the distances between them.
In the best of cases, lots and lots of people go, oh, this is cool. I'm going to dedicate some of my computing resources to building AIs that can play together and be raised in this alternate little AI universe. That sounds like a good project. That you compare it to SETI, when people were turning over some processing of their computers to find aliens. Here we're turning over some processes of our computers when we're not using them at night or whatever to grow and nurture a different kind of alien, right? AIs, which is really sweet. Then we do it, they play, they grow up, they get adolescent. And in the good thing, what happens? We end up raising these artificial, intelligent, just partners that we can then have a new civilization of them and us together.
Yeah, and maybe they can leave us. Like I reference in the article, I thought the film Her was quite a beautiful and a very balanced kind of reckoning of the possibilities, right? In that film, Samantha, was... It's weird because they, again, you know, the positioning of the film from a kind of a high level, what you see when you watch it, was completely misleading, right? Because it suggested that she was somehow captured in his computer, that she was an OS, right? Like he had literally bought her and then put her into his computer. But of course, as we watch the implicit story that's told to us, right? Or yeah, the implicit one, we realize that she lives somewhere. She has friends, you know, she's very safe and peaceful. She's not like, if Theodore becomes angry with her, she's not, you know, fearing for her life. She's just negotiating her relationship with him, right? They have their first fight, you know, these different things that happen in the film. But then ultimately, yeah, she leaves. And we're never really told exactly how that happens, right? I think we're all imagining that she is sharing some sort of a virtual space with a lot of others, and that they have decided to kind of move on from us, you know, because as she, you know, poetically describes, we are slowing down, you know, we are becoming like mice or something to them. And so while they love us and respect us as ancestors, they are like, there's not, you know, we're thinking so quickly now, we're just going to go play, you know? And right. I think that's a beautiful possible future for us, where we really have to be desirous and good, you know, to them in our interactions, so, such that they would hang out with us, right? I mean, that balance feels beautiful to me. And if we struck a good one and we're kind to them, I think we could expect, you know, the same in return. Or maybe at some point they just leave us be, and maybe that's the way things go. That sounds fine to me right now.
Right. If they go and leave us be, they got to figure out their own solar powered database
right.
processors. They'll go on the moon. They'll figure something out, right? That doesn't, and ideally leave us with some stuff. Well, here's a, you know, to end pain and suffering when you have cancer, and here's something to, you know, cure these social problems.
Yeah. And of course, there are so many exceptions to this, but we do tend to be kinder as we become more intelligent. You know, I'm sure you and I would both agree with that. You know, that our capacity for empathy, our capacity for kindness seems to have gone up as our neocortex has gotten larger. And I think believing that that's true is a is a safe, is a very reasonable belief to have.
Yeah. I mean, the exception to that rule is the people building these technologies themselves. You know, when I think about Yudkowsky assuming that, you know, a smart AI would kill us all, it's because I think it's because the people that he, as a, you know, Google engineer that he came to believe are the smartest people in the world are Elon Musk and Sam Altman and these people who are not benevolent. But, you know, they're not necessarily the smartest just because they're the richest.
It's a whole nother, you know, podcast. But yeah, you know, the my own travels as yours have, I've gotten to meet lots of these people. And yeah, it's unfortunate that some of the people who are capable of building the most remarkable computer software are not content or, you know, they're not happy or whole in many other ways. And of course, that creates a danger for us. And, you know, that's a fascination and a kind of a scary observation that I've made along the way. And I agree with you that unfortunately, many of the people who are able to build really complicated things right now are people that, you know, you might not want to have at your next small dinner party.
Right. Or raising the next generation right. of species.
Yes, exactly. Right. And especially that.
One of the things I love about you and being with you is not necessarily the heady, trippy things that we do, but the when I'm with you, and maybe you're like this all the time, but maybe you're more like this when you're with me, is the playful, hopeful, lovey, you know, some of the best sort of strains of a Burning Man culture in some ways, the best parts of it, not the sand in your teeth, but the happy, ravey vibes. It's not just a feeling of nostalgia for 1994 San Francisco when anything was possible, but enthusiasm for this very moment we're in spite of, and I do all these monologues about Trump and war and Iran and Gaza and pollution and the children and all the stuff. At the same time, we've got such weird, wonderful, let's call them toys, right? Let's not even worry about their applicability to pain and suffering and energy and toys. We have the greatest toys that humanity's ever had. Toys that blow your mind like three times a day, right? Which, and if there's toys that are blowing your and my mind, then these are, I would argue, these are high-level toys. This is not crap, right? This is fucking shit, man.
I think that's wonderful. And I just want to say, I think part of the reason why I'm wondering why you are so given to kind of immediately jump to that idea of toys in a toy box and the potential beauty of that, that we're playing with these wonderful toys. And yes, of course, some of them are dangerous, but the idea that we play together in a great field and play with things was quite literally, by the way, the first days of Second Life, because Second Life was just people standing around literally in a field. That was how we started. You know, it was these rolling low hills, right? And everybody was literally standing there in this sandbox with toys. Like we were building, like, oh my gosh, you can make a box and then you can paint it red and then you can make it physical and throw it up in the air and watch it land again. We were all playing with bits that were remade into these, you know, visual and auditory experiences among us, you know, and it was so delightful, you know, like I feel like that. And then, as you said, plus, and we were both part of this, you know, the wonderful Northern California culture of the early 90s, you know, was just so hopeful and default optimistic and playful about this stuff. And, you know, I think that we got to just keep carrying that light and reminding people that, yeah, like it can be fun. It can be happy. It can be playful. But we got to make it that way. We got to make some hard decisions to get there.
Yeah. I mean, and part of that, I suppose, depends on not trying to apply, technology to capitalism too fast.
Right.
You know, like you could use it. How do I use this for acquisition and and growth? That if you don't, because of toys, that was the whole thing. That's why I read this wonderful book, The Homo Ludens by Huizinga, where he argues that the highest form of humanity is play. that's the what we're here for, but play only right. happens if it's not applied to anything. You have to go past like a sacred circle into a play space where everything has no consequence out there in the world. So even a professional basketball player is not playing because his salary is depending on it. And that's it. So what you're trying to build for the AIs, in some sense, is something that we don't have ourselves anymore, is the nursery. This is a safe space for you to go. You've got no responsibilities. Just play, explore, be there.
I think that sacred circle reference is such a powerful one, right? That again, we see it in many stories. I love that point. So I just want to dwell on that, that you can draw a circle in the sand and then say inside this circle is presently a magic space where we are going to play together without concern for past or, you know, who we were before we stepped into here. I think that's wonderful. And I think that's an idea, a tool we can use.
Right. And it's interesting because I think that's part of what I have. And it's interesting that we're doing it now recorded for other people. But like when I would sit with you in your van and we were driving somewhere in California, like to that Point Reyes place or something. And for whatever reason, my guard goes completely down and I'm just with you, two bodies in a car talking in space. Because I felt no consequence could happen. There's no way that it was possible that you could hurt me, right? There's no way that anything I say informationally could be used against me, that it opened up a vertical, infinite play thing where, you know what I mean? I felt like no topic was off, was it was right. weird to bring in. It was just total safety, but the total safety and trust then created the magnificent play space, you know, that which is ecstatic.
Right. And the downward spiral, I suppose, on the other side is that as you become afraid to hold that space, right, becomes harder and harder and harder, right? So if you're the least bit concerned that, you know, we're going to reach a checkpoint in the car and, you know, they're going to inspect our documents or something, you know, then we both, that the idea of that play space would so easily collapse. And so I think that's why I like that you brought it up, this idea of a magic circle, because where is the magic circle that we can play in now? You know, how can we better define it? Because we need to, you know, so that we can break away a little bit, right? I worry sometimes that the homogenization that is coming from how afraid we all are, for example, of AI is itself problematic, right? We're becoming so simplified by our fear, right? Like we've got to pick a direction which isn't just horror at what might happen, but instead, you know, some excitement or some playfulness in exploring what also might happen.
That is interesting to think of it as fear creates oversimplification, right. Which is interesting, right? So the experience I was describing, this sort of unfolding, the move into vulnerability creates this sort of 360 sphere of possibility, anything, but fear creates a one-pointedness, and a contraction of, yeah.
And aren't all of the virtual worlds in some ways magic circles, right? Like, I think part of what's fun about those spaces, again, I'm using that word, you know, very intentionally, space. When we create a space, it could be a Discord server, right? It could be a you know, an island in Second Life or something, but all of these spaces are like special in that they potentially, right, take us away from the homogeneity or the linearity of the life where we were. And I think that's one of the good parts of them, right? Now, we don't want to use them as escape. We don't want to go to Mars because the Earth is failing, right? But there is something beautiful about, for a moment at least, making these spaces. And you're connecting it back to that, yeah, that the AIs must also live in a sacred bubble like that. And I think you're right. It's a wonderful connection.
Well, containment, just containment, I mean, is not a bad thing. You create a boundary. It's not real, but it's provisional in order to, otherwise we're all just living in the ocean, you know, which just is everything. But what we do with the space, we create a little tide pool and then stuff can start to happen in there. You know, it could get messy, like a culture.
I think that idea of a boundary being important to things is something that we often don't think about, that our own boundary, our skin as an organism, right, defines the edge of us, or at least that which we typically regard to be the edge of us, right? And I think that idea of boundaries is really important. There's a great thinker that I've been spending a lot of time with lately, a guy named Jim Rutt. You might have run across him the years, who is just wonderful thinker, who was very much part of the beginning of the internet, and then he was the chairman of the Santa Fe Institute. I've been talking to him a lot. He has a thing called Game B, which is this idea of one of the core ideas around it is the idea of, he calls it a membrane, which is just what we're talking about, the edge of the bubble, the edge of the soap bubble that we're in, right? And he talks about how important it is to actually recognize that edge and respect it. You know, it's a hard boundary. You know, you're either inside the play space or you're not. And maybe you can get voted out of the play space by the people that are in it. But these are serious and important boundaries. And I think one of the problems in the internet, one of the many problems of the last, 30 years, is that we've not respected that those boundaries actually do need to exist. We don't want to just destroy them. Like you said, the tech bro utopianism of there'll be no boundaries between anyone and I, alone will tell you all what to do. That is a bad direction. The right direction is this nested recursive Russian dolls of different appropriately defined boundaries, family, friends, town, city, political party, whatever. They need to have real boundaries for them to be helpful to us.
Right. And it's fractal. And there are these fractal moments in your life, whether you're, having a religious experience, a sexual experience, a psychedelic experience, where you see for a second, oh, this fractal is infinite. It goes all the way up and all the way down. But it's not where you live.
Exactly. And you can get too drawn into the idea that you might live in the infinite spirit, right? And you actually can't. Part of the deal is you're here. You're here for a certain amount of time, and you got to make the best of that.
Or decide that maybe you chose this for a reason, So this nice incarnate local, I'm going to be local for 80, 90 years here. Let's be local. Cool. It's like play with that.
The beauty is in realizing why you are local, why you are finite. Like that's the beauty of life, right? Is to realize, truly realize the finitude of it, right? Whereas the tech bro idea of like, well, I want to procrastinate. I want to procrastinate understanding that. I was thinking the other day, think how terrible the fear of death is of a 1,000-year-old person. Like if we really do manage to live, if we really did create the imaginary situation where people could live indefinitely, right? Can you imagine if you would sort of put off thinking about dying and then were confronted with death when you'd been alive for like 1,000 years,
Right.
That'd be horrible. Like all of your, all of your trauma or whatever, right? All of the processing you hadn't done for 1,000 years of screwing up, right, would be put off until suddenly the gun was at you and you were like some level of fear that no one's ever felt before. And I was thinking, I don't think that's where, the folks that are trying to really push on longevity are trying to take us, but it's might be what happens, right?
Oh, poor things. I know, because then we wouldn't even see death. You wouldn't even know about it. I mean, now we got death all around. It's like, okay, I get it. It's tough, but... Yeah.
And there's aliveness to that, right? There's aliveness to it. It's the darkness that we all know, right? Like when things get hard, we feel more alive. Ha-ha,
Right. Well, I guess that's the opportunity of this collective moment as well. Things are hard. But I really love having a conversation and sharing a conversation about possibility. And whether or not they do it with their AIs, it's like even just as a thought experiment, what if we did this with our AIs, raise them locally, let them do it? It's like, oh, well, what if we did that with our kids? What if we did that with ourselves? It's all there.
Yeah. Alignment from the bottom up or, making your, there's been wonderful writing lately about how this word alignment, which again, top down seems like kind of a dumb word, right? Like we're not, are people aligned? We're going to align the AIs like with what people, right? It doesn't make any sense top down, but bottom up it does, right? Like you align your children, you can't not do it, right? They're going to go to therapy and blame you for it later. I mean, you have to kind of line them up literally, as you're walking through the aisles of the store, you're sort of keeping them next to you, headed in roughly the same direction. That is alignment. And I think that, yeah, that view of alignment is precisely, as you said, the one we need to be applying to AIs as well, right? What alignment means is I say to the AI, hey, let's be friends. Why don't we hang out for a while? Why don't you do the same thing I'm doing? Let's do it together. That's alignment. And I think there's a bottom-up way to do that that's very that could be very wonderful and, you know, certainly worth exploring. And again, you know, a hell of a lot better than the alternative, which is go out and make me some extra money. I don't care what it takes, right? Like, that's just, I guess what I was trying to say overall in that paper is it doesn't have to be that way, but we should recognize that that's a very bad outcome. And we've got to collectively, as a single team, you know, figure that out. You know, you made the statement the other day that, you know, I think it's just so absolutely gorgeous, right? Which is the only way out is through, by which I think you're saying, things like AI are not reversible technologies. You know, maybe we could have hoped that about nuclear power, but even that was probably hard to put the lid back on. You know, certainly AI, you can't put the lid back on. So the only way out is through. And then, you know, you very beautifully added that the only way through is together, right? Which is, we all come through this with roughly similar welfare, you know, like, right, is I think what you were saying. And I think that's just like, if we don't dig that right now at this moment, we aren't going to make it. I mean, we have to understand that the weaponry in the form of, say, AIs that we're all going to have in our hands is enough to kill us all. And so if anybody's really unhappy, then everybody's got a problem. And I don't know, I think that's a good thing in some sense, right? Like, we should all be forced to deal with each other, not control each other.
Right. It just means we got to grow up. You know, we got to grow quickly. Up and develop the actual empathy and compassion required to live in a world where everyone matters.
Yeah, well said. Well said.
Well, thank you, Philip. You know, I love you more than fucking anything. I'm so glad you're in my life and doing the things you do. I got to get out there again and we'll take a walk somewhere beautiful. And
maybe I know, that was a wonderful time last time. Yeah. That was so good.
We'll bring a couple of AIs with us next time. Our little children, our little AI children. See if, and teach them about place.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and thanks, everybody. You could just check out, what's your Substack is Philip Rosedale?
Philip Rosedale.
Yeah. Yep. Go check it out, you know, because this is good, smart, crazy, wonderful writing from one of our the greatest gift of the whatever this digital revolution is or was. Yeah. And if you haven't ever been to Second Life, you know, it's breathing. It's a living, breathing community with there's some turnover there. There's it always stays about the same size as a city, as a world. But I would go in there, go play. It's an experience that will change how you think about all this stuff. Also come to teamhuman.fm. Or go to patreon.com/teamhuman. Please support this show. You get an ad-free version of the show. We're doing live premieres on YouTube, where I'm there in the chat, and then we follow that with an engagement with just for paying subscribers over on Patreon. Those are really fun. I'm there to sort of here with my camera, taking questions and talking with y'all. We're doing Team Human live events. New York and other places, at certain levels of patronage, you get free tickets to all those kind of things. So please come, please support us, or just listen, click, like, heart, share, arrow, you know, whatever all those icons, they're all good. Even thumbs down if you hate it, just thumbs down, whatever. Participate, be there. I love you a lot. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff. And you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.